Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, the New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 434, recorded on Sunday, July 10th, 2022. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
Well, a really exciting episode for everyone today. This week, we're talking about another of the key corporate monopolies of the Second Industrial Revolution in the United States, one which arguably undergirded the operations of every single other monopoly in all the other industries of that era by linking together people and businesses over long distances in the second half of the 19th century. We're looking at Western Union, the Telegraph and Telegram Company. From their start in 1851, over 15 years, they managed to acquire every other competing company until they were effectively the only national company left in the game by 1866. Although some other companies would be established to try to compete with their monopoly, Western Union would continually end up absorbing these rivals as well. Despite basically missing the boat on the advent of the telephone, there were many technologies where Western Union was a leader, even in the 20th century, and the company still exists today, once again independent after various periods of parent ownership in different conglomerates. While they ended telegram operations in 2006, Western Union remains a giant in the field of money transfers around the world, which we'll also talk more about. This episode is a really great one to think about the role of communications technologies in economic activity, as well as the physical material limitations and costs for installation and usage of physical infrastructure and how those affect the uses of those technologies. And let's also keep in mind throughout this episode all the specialist laborers involved, even if they're not mentioned that much in the narrative, who operated the equipment every day and maintained or installed it in often difficult conditions. All right, Rachel, can you tell us about the origins of Western Union and its consolidation toward monopoly status in the United States?
Yeah, so first, let's get a grasp of the technology and the history of the technology. So in 1838, Samuel Morse obtained the patent for a single-wire electric telegraph, but he split the patent right to attract wealthy partners. He also had a few people helping him develop this technology. Leonard Gale and Alfred Vail both helped develop the electric telegraph technology, and they also provided labor and material support. And so in exchange, each held a quarter of the patent right. In 1843, 5 years later, Morse obtained a government grant to build an experimental telegraph line between Baltimore and Washington, D.C. Two men, F.O.J. Smith, a former Maine representative, and Hiram Sibley, a businessman, helped Morse get that government grant and to help fund his experimental line. The line was completed in 1844, and Morse transmitted the first public telegraph message, pretty famously, "What hath God wrought?" And this history is coming from both the Encyclopedia Britannica article on the Western Union Corporation and an Economic History Association article on the website eh.net, which does include a fairly detailed bibliography if you want some further sources for reading. So Morse pretty much knew he didn't have like the business side of things down. So he brought in Amos Kendall, a former postmaster general and a former member of President Jackson's kitchen, quote unquote, kitchen cabinet to manage the three quarters of the patent right that was shared by Morse, Gale, and Vail. Smith managed the other quarter of the patent. Eventually, this partnership soured and the partners decided to split the patent right along geographical lines, with Smith controlling New England, New York, and the upper Midwest, and Morse controlling the rest of the country. Morse did try to sell the patent to the government as a complete patent, but he was unsuccessful. And Kendall also tried to create interest in developing a unified telegraph system in the U.S., but he too was unsuccessful. So the patent right got sold piecemeal to regional interests. And so the technology and the right to operate it was just really broken up into these regional business interests. At the same time, there were some rival patents going on. Royal House and Alexander Bain introduced rival patents in 1846 and 1849. Entrepreneurs constructed competing lines on the major eastern routes using the new patents. The House device needed a higher quality wire and more insulation, as it was a more precise instrument. It had a keyboard at one end and printed out letters at the other. At its peak, it could send messages considerably faster than Morse's technique. The Bain device was similar to Morse's, except that instead of creating the famous dots and dashes, it discolored a piece of chemically treated paper by sending an electric current through it. Neither competitor had success initially, leading Kendall to underestimate their eventual impact on the market. By 1851, 10 separate firms ran lines into New York City. There were 3 competing lines between New York and Philadelphia, 3 between New York and Boston, and 4 between New York and Buffalo. In addition, 2 lines operated between Philadelphia to Pittsburgh, 2 between Buffalo and Chicago, 3 between points in the Midwest and New Orleans, and entrepreneurs erected lines between many Midwestern cities. In all, in 1851, the Bureau of the Census reported 75 companies with 21,147 miles of wire. Telegraph firms competed against rivals on the same route, but sought alliances with firms with which they connected. For example, 4 firms, New York, Albany, and Buffalo, New York State Printing, Merchant State, and New York and Erie, competed on the route between New York City and Buffalo. Rates fell dramatically by more than 50%, as new firms entered, so this market was quite competitive for a while. But each of these firms sought to create an alliance with connecting firms, such as those with lines from New York City to Boston or Washington. Increased business from exchanging messages meant increased profitability. Horizontal integration, which is integration between 2 competing firms, and system integration, which is integration between 2 connecting firms, occurred in the telegraph industry during different periods. System integration occurred between 1846 and 1852, as main lines acquired most of the feeder lines in the country. In 1852, the Supreme Court declared the Bain telegraph an infringement on Morse's patent, and Bain lines merged with Morse lines across the country. Between 1853 and 1857, regional monopolies formed and signed the Treaty of Six Nations, a pooling agreement between the 6 largest regional firms. During this phase, the industry experienced both horizontal and system integration. By the end of the period, most remaining firms were regional monopolists, controlled several large cities, and owned both the House and Morse patents. And one of those companies was founded in 1851 by Hiram Sibley, who was one of the people who helped Morse get that initial funding. So he and other Rochester citizens formed the New York and Mississippi Valley Printing Telegraph Company, which bought 11 small lines north of the Ohio River. In 1856, the company was renamed the Western Union Telegraph Company, and Sibley became its president. And under his leadership, the first transcontinental telegraph line was built in 1861. So Western Union went on to become one of these large monolithic companies. The final phase of integration occurred between 1857 and 1866. In this period, the pool members consolidated into a national monopoly. By 1864, only Western Union and the American Telegraph Company remained of the 6 nations. The United States Telegraph Company entered the field by consolidating smaller, independent firms in the early 1860s and operated in the territory of both the American Telegraph Company and Western Union. By 1866, Western Union absorbed its last 2 competitors and reached its position of market dominance. And some of these developments sound very familiar, very similar to what was happening in railroad construction. There are all these competing firms popping up and then getting absorbed by bigger and bigger entities. So the telegraph and the railroad were natural partners in commerce. The telegraph needed the right-of-way that the railroads provided, and the railroads needed the telegraph to coordinate the arrival and departure of trains. These synergies were not immediately recognized. Only in 1851 did railways start to use telegraphy. Prior to that, telegraph wires strung along the tracks were seen as a nuisance, occasionally sagging and causing accidents and even fatalities. The greatest savings of the telegraph were from the continued use of single-tracked railroad lines. prior to 1851, the U.S. system was single-tracked, and trains ran on a time interval system. Two types of accidents could occur. Trains running in opposite directions could run into one another, as could trains running in the same direction. The potential for accidents required that railroad managers be very careful in dispatching trains. One way to reduce the number of accidents would have been to double-track the system. A second, better way was to use the telegraph. Double-tracking was a good alternative, but not perfect. Double-tracked lines would eliminate head-on collisions, but not same-direction ones. This would still need to be done using a timing system, i.e. requiring a time interval between departing trains. Accidents were still possible using this system. By using the telegraph, station managers knew exactly what trains were on the tracks under their supervision. Double-tracking the U.S. rail system in 1893 has been estimated to cost $957 million. Western Union's book capitalization was $123 million in 1893, making this seem like a good investment. So another way the telegraph industry was so big during this Second Industrial Revolution was they were able to offer money transfers starting in 1857. And this was a very lucrative side service that they provided. So starting in 1871, Western Union offered customer-to-customer money transfer services, and they piloted the program in New York, Chicago, and Boston. And by the end of 1871, they were able to offer these services to the entire country. So the way a wire money transfer works was a customer paid money to one office where an operator transmitted a telegraphic message and quote-unquote wired the money to another office. So this, of course, requires the company to float a significant amount of cash in physical form in various geographic locations in order to make the money materialize on the receiving end. It's basically a 19th century higher-speed version of the Medici Bank offering money transfers at various locations in Europe to member merchants so that they didn't need to move cash with them, except now anyone could do it. Any customer was able to transfer money or receive money. For security, passwords and code books were used to authorize the release of the funds to the recipient. And by 1877, the service was used to transfer almost $2.5 million each year, which was a ton of money in those days. In later years, Western Union became a global money transfer service. So today, Western Union is a global money transfer service and one of the biggest in the world, but they actually didn't begin worldwide operations until after the Record Carrier Competition Act of 1981 in the United States significantly deregulated them. And there was generally an ongoing process of international financial services deregulation in the 1980s. And today, they are currently second only to PayPal in volume of worldwide money transfers. Much of their business is considered to be remittance payments from individuals working in one country to relatives living in another country. Hundreds of billions of dollars in remittance payments flow through money transfer companies each year, vastly more than the amount of foreign aid or development aid from rich countries to poorer countries. Western Union, which is considered the leader in remittance payments specifically, as opposed to the broader world of money transfers, makes its money from a flat fee on the transaction, and then a profit margin from currency exchange rate plays when converting the money between the sender's location and the recipient's location. The recipients can either arrange to pick up cash from an agent, or the money can go directly into a bank account if those are available, accessible, and reliable in that part of the world. Another company with a well-known global brand in the sector of remittance transfers is MoneyGram, which emerged out of the 1940s Travelers Express Company, also based in the U.S. It is probably the closest competitor to Western Union today, and we found a pretty good Business Insider article that explains the various remittance companies that are operating in the world today.
So that's obviously the current situation with Western Union, but let's go back in time to their peak era, their monopoly era. So Rachel's very carefully explained the early telegraph years, how the companies came together to eventually consolidate into basically one national company. And now this is the golden age for Western Union, although as we'll talk about, it had a much longer life beyond that than you might have realized. After the mergers of the 1850s and the 1860s that left it for a while as the only national firm in telegraphy, Western Union's first rival was the Atlantic and Pacific Telegraph Company, a conglomeration of new and merged lines created by Jay Gould in 1874. Gould sought to wrest control of the Western Union from the Vanderbilts, and he actually succeeded in 1881 when the two firms merged. But, of course, that means that it's back to being just one firm. A more permanent rival appeared in the 1880s in the form of the Postal Telegraph Company. John Mackay, who had already made a fortune at the Comstock Lode, headed this firm. Mackay did what many of his telegraph predecessors did in the 1850s, create a network by buying out existing bankrupt firms. These would have been small, little regional or even local telegraph firms that weren't really competing directly with Western Union per se, but obviously inherently struggled against it. And then they would merge them into one large network, and that would have large enough economies of scale to try to compete with Western Union. However, Postal Telegraph never challenged Western Union's market dominance, but did control over 10 to 20% of the market at various times. And that's according to that article from the Economic History Association. And of course, no surprise there, but Western Union did eventually also buy Postal Telegraph out in the 1940s. Gradually, Western Union absorbed more than 500 telegraph companies throughout the nation, growing so much that by 1884, it was included in the original 11 stocks traded in the very first Dow Jones average, which started in 1884. So let's talk a little bit about the economic impact of, well, Western Union or the telegraph industry, but those are, as we've shown, effectively synonymous when we're talking about large-scale telegraphy nationwide in the United States. So, quoting again from this Economic History Association article, industries that had a high inventory turnover also benefited from the telegraph. Of particular importance were industries in which the product was perishable. These industries included meat packing and the distribution of fruits and vegetables. The growth of both of these industries was facilitated by the introduction of the refrigerated car in 1874. You can actually listen to our episode on the natural ice trade and refrigeration if you want to know more about that. The telegraph was required for the exact control of shipments. For instance, refrigeration in the telegraph allowed for the slaughter and disassembly of livestock in the giant stockyards of Chicago, Kansas City, St. Louis, and Omaha. Beef would then be shipped east at a cost of 50% of that of shipping the live cattle. The centralization of the stockyards also created tremendous amounts of byproducts that could be processed into glue, tallow, dye, fertilizer, feed, brushes, false teeth, gelatin, oleomargarine, and many other useful products. The telegraph undoubtedly had a major impact on the structure of financial markets in the United States. New York became the financial center of the country, setting prices for a variety of commodities and financial instruments. Among these were beef, corn, wheat, stocks, and bonds. As the telegraph spread, so too did the centralization of prices. For instance, in 1846, wheat and corn prices in Buffalo lagged 4 days behind those in New York City. In 1848, the two markets were linked telegraphically, and prices were set simultaneously. And then the article continues later. The centralization of stock prices helped make New York the financial capital of the United States. Over the course of the 19th century, hundreds of exchanges appeared and then disappeared across the country. Few of them remained, with only those in New York, Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco achieving any permanence. By 1910, 90% of all bond and two-thirds of all stock trades occurred in the New York Stock Exchange. Centralization of the market created much more liquidity for stockholders. As the number of potential traders increased, so too did the ability to find a buyer or seller of a financial instrument. This increase in liquidity may have led to an increase in the total amount invested in the market, therefore leading to higher levels of investment and economic growth. Centralization may also have led to the development of certain financial institutions that could not have developed otherwise. Although difficult to quantify, these aspects of centralization certainly had a positive effect on economic growth. In some respects, however, we may tend to overestimate the telegraph's influence on the economy. The rapid distribution of information may have had a collective action problem associated with it. If no one else in Buffalo has a piece of information, such as the change in the price of wheat in New York City, then there is a large private incentive to discover that piece of information quickly, but once everyone has the information, no one made better off. A great deal of effort may have been spent on an endeavor that, from a society's perspective, did not increase overall efficiency. The centralization in New York also increased the gains from other wealth-neutral or wealth-reducing activities, such as speculation and market manipulation. Higher volumes of trading increased the payoff from the successful manipulation of the market, but did not increase society's wealth. So, I mean, some obvious pros and cons there, but basically just that, yes, the telegraph helped them to do some actual real-world productive economic activities more efficiently and centrally, but it also certainly increased the ability for pretty wide-scale speculation and other kind of sketchy activities on the stock exchange. So let's talk now about Western Union's political power by the end of the 19th century, the turn of the last century. Same article. The period from 1866 through the turn of the century was the apex of Western Union's power. Yearly messages sent over its lines increased from 5.8 million in 1867 to 63.2 million in 1900. Over the same period, transmission rates fell from an average of $1.09 to 30 cents per message. Even with these lower prices, roughly 30 to 40 cents of every dollar of revenue were net profit for the company. Western Union faced three threats during this period: increased government regulation, new entrants into the field of telegraphy, and new competition from the telephone. The last two were the most important to the company's future profitability. And then they continue. Western Union was the first nationwide industrial monopoly, with over 90% of the market share and dominance in every state. The states and the federal government responded to this market power. State regulation was largely futile given the interstate character of the industry. On the federal level, bills were introduced in almost every session of Congress calling for either regulation of or government entry into the industry. Western Union's lobby was able to block almost any legislation. The few regulations that were passed either helped Western Union maintain its control over the market or were never enforced. By 1900, and this is quoting now from the Herald Dispatch in West Virginia, in Huntington, West Virginia. By 1900, Western Union operated 1 million miles of telegraph lines and 2 international undersea cables. In cities large and small, its uniformed messenger boys could be seen bicycling around town to deliver telegraphs to recipients. The company continued to grow. In 1914, it offered the first charge card for consumers, and singing telegrams followed in 1933. End quote. 1900, however, was the heyday of rapid growth in the telegraphy business in the United States, and by 1930, the actual volume of messages peaked at around 212 million per year and then began to decline. The Great Depression arrived at the same time as new alternative messaging technologies, even setting aside the continued rise of the long-distance telephone service for instant verbal communication, and that all made the cost of sending a telegram harder to justify. So let's talk now about the telephone, because this is obviously very important to the story and the arc and trajectory of Western Union. Essentially, they fumbled the ball on this, but not necessarily for the reasons you might think. Western Union's greatest threat, and this is quoting now again from the Economic History Association article, came from a new technology, the telephone. Alexander Graham Bell patented the telephone in 1876, initially referring to it as a talking telegraph. Bell offered Western Union the patent for the telephone for $100,000, but the company declined to purchase it. Western Union could have easily gained control of AT&T in the 1890s, but management decided that higher dividends were more important than expansion. I also had read one source, I'll just digress here, that indicated that they also somehow thought that, and I guess this is maybe based on how many patents had been involved in the earlier phase of the development of the telegraph, but they kind of thought that they could just get some of their inventor team to reinvent the telephone, you know, with a new patent in a way that they wouldn't have to deal with Bell and it would be in-house. And that just ended up in a bunch of litigation that didn't work out for them. So again, they missed the boat, and maybe it was because they thought they could do it better. But as we'll see, there's some other reasons as well. And that is basically that the telephone was used in the 1880s only for local calling. But with the development of the 1890s long lines, the telephone offered increased competition to the telegraph. In 1900, local calls accounted for 97% of the telephone's business, and it was not until the 20th century that the telephone fully displaced the telegraph. End quote. And I think it's important to underscore that last point because, in my view, it helps explain why Western Union didn't jump at the chance to acquire the telephone, even if you take out patent shenanigans. Fundamentally, it comes down to this. Most of their business was in longer-distance written communications, and very few people were making long-distance voice calls at great expense for the first several decades. Short-distance written communications that were most threatened by early telephone service would also have been sent more often via the local mail pickups and drop-offs, as we covered in our August 2020 episode on the Postal Service, right? You're not going to go down to your Western Union agent and have them type in a message that's just going to be have to be typed out again in the same city and sent to the post office for the mail carrier to drop off in the multiple rounds through the business district of your same city. That obviously doesn't make sense. So that's not a situation where Western Union is competing with the telephone, whereas the telephone is competing with the local mail. And as I said, we covered that the mail aspect on our August 2020 episode on the Postal Service. But meanwhile, just a couple years before the invention of the telephone, so this is in the mid-1870s, Western Union had purchased Thomas Edison's new quadruplex telegraph invention that allowed for four telegraph messages to be sent simultaneously over a single wire, two each way at once, and then correctly processed out by machines at both ends, thereby vastly increasing the daily or hourly message capacity over the same physical infrastructure. And that's a point we talked about in a previous episode about telegraphy, is that you have to remember that you couldn't just send an infinite number of messages over a single wire, so you did have to put up a lot of wires over the same route in order to support a high volume of messages, and that is another thing to keep in mind when you're comparing these various communications technologies at the time. So, to Western Union, at the time, that quadruplex telegraph technology would have seemed like a massively important breakthrough in terms of their business, especially in contrast with the poor sound quality of early telephone service and the capital problems associated with any increased need for physical infrastructure to be installed over long distances. Ultimately, however, AT&T ended up acquiring Western Union instead of the other way around, which eventually finally led to anti-monopoly action by the U.S. government related to Western Union at long last, but that was via the AT&T Sherman Antitrust Act suit. Quoting again from the Economic History Association article, in 1909, AT&T gained control of Western Union by purchasing 30% of its stock. In many ways, the companies were heading in opposite directions. AT&T was expanding rapidly, while Western Union was content to reap handsome profits and issue large dividends, but not reinvest in itself. Oh, where have we heard that story before? Under AT&T's ownership, Western Union was revitalized, but the two companies separated in 1913, succumbing to pressure from the Department of Justice. In 1911, the Department of Justice successfully used the Sherman Antitrust Act to force a breakup of Standard Oil. This success made the threat of antitrust action against AT&T very credible. Both Postal Telegraph and the independent telephone companies, wishing to interconnect with AT&T, lobbied for government regulation. In order to forestall any such government action, AT&T issued the Kingsbury Commitment, a unilateral commitment to divest itself of Western Union and allow independent telephone firms to interconnect. For much of the early to mid-20th century, and even some of the third quarter of the 20th century, as communications technologies advanced, I think it was an open question whether the telephone or the telegraph would become the basis of more complex communications networks. We obviously don't think about that now, but it's important to think about it from the point of view of the people developing this stuff at the time. For example, would telephones carry faxes and the future internet, or actually would telegraphs? In the end, other far more advanced cables and light-based fiber optics and so on would displace both, but for a long time, these two technologies, telephones and telegraphs, were seriously in competition for supporting some of those secondary communications technologies and undergirding the coming third industrial revolution around computer technologies. So, Rachel, you're going to talk a little bit now about some of those technologies, starting with the telegraph version of the fax system.
Yeah, so we found a WesternUnion.com blog that kind of details some of the historical milestones in Western Union history. And according to this blog, Western Union started offering telefax services in 1935, although the service was most popular in the 1940s through the 1960s. So people could transmit images over the telegraph lines using a quote-unquote desk fax machine, which would print the images on carbon paper that was coated. And then a stylus would conduct an electric current to the paper and burn the coating off, exposing the carbon. And so that way it could print both images and type. This innovation was to obviate the need for telegraph messengers, which were quite expensive, and also to provide that direct desk-to-desk service, kind of cutting out the middlemen of the telegram messengers, the telegram operators.
Or also just cutting out the internal in-house corporate person that has to carry a message from some central communications hub to your desk.
Exactly. However, as telephone line facsimile technology improved and telephonic long-distance rates went down, the popularity of the telefax decreased. They just couldn't compete and offer the same service for lower prices that the telephone companies could offer for their facsimile technology.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about microwave communications. This was another big play in the mid-20th century by Western Union to remain ahead of the curve and keep the telegraph relevant. And then Rachel's going to talk about another technology as well. But in the 1940s, during and just after World War II, Western Union began developing and then offering city-to-city microwave communications transmissions, beating AT&T to the market. This was a new technology, and the FCC during the later stages of the war had decided to let the private sector figure out something civilian to do with it. Companies like Western Union rushed to build microwave relays across the countryside, often on mountaintops, between certain major cities. For example, in 1945, Western Union microwave relays linked New York to D.C. via Philadelphia and D.C. to Pittsburgh, and then Pittsburgh back to New York. Between each of these major terminals would be more than half a dozen relay sites spaced about 25 to 35 miles apart. The relay towers Western Union installed were initially basically just copies of the existing U.S. Forest Service fire lookout tower designs, which the Forest Service provided information and experience on. These wireless microwave relays could replace, with much higher volume capacity, the vast network of physical wires and cables providing long-distance communications across the United States at the time, and in Western Union's case, obviously, telegraph communications specifically. The Christian Science Monitor in 1945 called the system a poleless telegraph. The New York to D.C. microwave relay could transmit over 2,000 written messages simultaneously. And again, remember, since we're talking about this in the pre-email era, we are talking about that there is still a distinction to be made between the telegraph and the telephone. They're not exactly competing with each other because one is doing voice communications and one is doing written communications, and those obviously both still have utility to a lot of consumers and businesses. There's a fantastic article, journal article from the History Cooperative. I wasn't sure if it was a peer-reviewed thing or not, but it was like somebody's big research project and also has a huge bibliography. And this was published in the mid-2000s, and it's specifically about the development of the Western Union microwave network. And it's fascinating overall and talks about the whole licensing process with the FCC and how they figured out how to build the towers and where to build them and how they did the real estate acquisitions for that. So you can kind of think about all these different elements that go into that. But anyway, they say at one point this observation, which I thought was worth mentioning, quote, "Western Union was an industry leader in telecommunications, first in wireline telegraphy in the 19th century, next with commercial facsimile services in the first half of the 20th century, and ultimately with microwave telecommunications in the post-war years. Despite its path-breaking innovations, the company repeatedly found itself losing its market share to the Bell system. Telephony made it possible to bring telecommunications into the office and home. Western Union's attempts to reinvent itself through technological innovation repeatedly failed. Its microwave network, which was part of a $62 million 7-year capital improvement program, was hailed by Wall Street as a potential cure to the company's financial and labor woes in the 1940s. The promising outlook signaled by the adoption of the new technology, however, was short-lived," end quote. So, as I said, there is this ongoing sort of rivalry with somewhat different purposes between telegraphy and telephones in the United States. And as we know, as we're moving ourselves toward getting into talking more about the Third Industrial Revolution, ultimately what's going to matter is who ends up providing internet services, or whatever you want to call it, linking up computers at various places. And we've seen that there's this telefax forerunner that uses telegraph instead of the telephone, but they ultimately go with the telephone. So what was going to happen here? Were they going to have these computers linked, whether it was mainframe computers or desktop computers ultimately? Were these going to be linked by telegraph, or were they going to be linked by telephone? We obviously know the ultimate outcome there is that in most places, with some exceptions in Europe, dial-up telephone became the winner there, although it was fairly quickly replaced by things like broadband and fiber optics and so forth, as I said earlier. But Rachel, can you tell us about the big play that Western Union made to be the backbone of what might have eventually become the internet using telegraphy instead of telephony?
So there's a technology called Telex, which was developed in Germany in the 1920s and 1930s, and it did spread through Europe in the post-World War II period. And it's a text-based two-way messaging system that uses telegraph lines for transmission and prints messages using teleprinters. And it's the predecessor to modern fax, email, and text messaging. Western Union in the U.S. was a relative latecomer And they built their network in 1958. And the way it worked is you would have these teleprinters in your office or business, and you basically had to call to the end point of where you wanted to send your text message. In the U.S., the telex numbering plan, usually a six-digit number in the United States, was based on the major exchange where the customer's telex machine terminated. For example, all telex customers that terminated in the New York City exchange were assigned a telex number that started with the first digit 1. Further, all Chicago-based customers had telex numbers that started with the first digit of 2. This numbering plan was maintained by Western Union as the telex exchanges proliferated to smaller cities in the United States. The Western Union telex network was built on 3 levels of exchanges. The highest level was made up of the 9 exchange cities previously mentioned, the big ones. Each of these cities had the dual capability of terminating telex customer lines and setting up trunk connections to multiple distant telex exchanges. The second level of exchanges, located in large cities such as Buffalo, Cleveland, Miami, Newark, Pittsburgh, and Seattle, were similar to the highest level of exchanges in capability of terminating telex customer lines and setting up trunk connections. However, these second level exchanges had a smaller customer line capacity and only had trunk circuits connected to regional cities. The third level of exchanges, located in small to medium-sized cities, could terminate telex customer lines and had a single trunk group running to its parent exchange. So there's these kind of like hub and spoke networks connecting large cities and then gradually going out to smaller and smaller cities. Western Union also offered connections from telex to AT&T's rival system, the AT&T Teletypewriter Exchange, or the TWX system, in May 1966 via its New York Information Services Computer Center. And USA-based telex users could send the same message to several places around the world at the same time, like email today, using the Western Union InfoMaster computer. This involved transmitting the message via paper tape to the InfoMaster computer, which was dial code 6111, and specifying the destination addresses for the single text. In this way, a single message could be sent to multiple distant telex and TWX machines, as well as delivering the same message to non-telex and non-TWX subscribers via Western Union Mailgram. So it was a very primitive version of both email and text messaging and kind of an early internet analog. So it was very interesting that it just kind of reached like a dead end point as dial-up internet kind of proliferated and kind of won this competition in rival technologies.
Yeah, and I think it's easy to say in retrospect, well, of course telephones were going to win because, you know, everyone already had a telephone by the same big national monopoly in their homes. So then when you get to the consumer level, you don't have to add a connection. But we know that's not necessarily the way things had to play out because obviously, there was telegraph lines everywhere in the country, not necessarily to people's houses, but to every city that were Western Union, whether it was physical lines or these microwave-backed lines. And we also know that in Europe, people did run telex lines to their house. There was, especially in Britain, telex became a big thing at the consumer level, not just at the enterprise level. And people would have little computers that they would log on to their telex connection and go on to their sort of parallel alt history version of the internet and the World Wide Web and talk to each other and visit commercial websites and things like that. So it didn't necessarily have to go that way. And I think it's also probably worth thinking about the pricing systems as well, right? That the cost of telegraphy was going up over this period, whereas the cost of phone calls per minute was going down. And so you're looking at a per-minute model when you're talking about dial-up internet versus per-word pricing method via telegraphy, just because that's how they had traditionally been doing stuff previously. But it is sort of an interesting thing to think about, the road not taken there. And I think we will probably have to talk more about telex at some point because we've already discussed it in relation to Chile and Project Cybersyn. But the big obstacle for us on this show is that we're focusing on U.S. History and technology, industrial history. And this was a much more of a European technology, both in origin in Germany and its usage in Western Europe. And this Western Union deployment in the United States was kind of an outlier, which is, of course, what makes it noteworthy for today's episode. So I want to talk about one more big thing. This was, obviously, we've already talked about how Western Union eventually pivoted to being a purely money services company after the 1980s, and particularly dropping their final telegraphy services in 2006. But there's one final gasp where Western Union makes a bid for relevance against all these other companies, and they're going to have a big breakthrough, and they're going to be the next big thing, and that is in the field of commercial satellites. So in April 1974, Western Union had the first commercially launched U.S. communications satellite in geosynchronous orbit called Westar. It was launched a dozen years after the first experimental Telstar communication satellite, which had been jointly, privately, and publicly owned by AT&T, Bell Labs, NASA, the British company GPO, and the French company National PTT. The Westar satellites were relaying telegram and telex message traffic, but also video, voice, data, and fax transmissions by third-party companies leasing the partial use of these satellites. Western Union eventually launched five of these satellites out of a planned seven, which operated until 1984, a decade later, and they provided microwave communications for the company. Unfortunately, by this point, the company was really struggling financially and about to enter restructuring, and the satellite program was not helping. And so they decided to bow out of the commercial space race, selling off that program and its remainders to the Hughes Aircraft Company, which had built the satellites originally. And in fact, this satellite sell-off only preceded the company's sell-off of its physical telegraphy infrastructure by a few years. However, it is worth noting, and I think interesting, that the primary uplink station for the Western Union satellite fleet, located in Glenwood, New Jersey, is now where Sirius XM satellite radio is uplinked from. So, gone but not forgotten completely from the field of commercial satellites. So, as we said, from that point forward, Western Union was pretty much focused on the global remittance payments industry, and they're very effective at that, and they got out of the telegraphy game. But a storied company, the first of the big industrial interstate commerce monopolies in the United States, the one that made a lot of the enterprise operations possible for those other companies we've talked about. It's amazing that we've taken this long to get around to talking to this, but I'm glad that we did, because we were kind of able to bridge that period from coming out of the 1850s at the end of the first industrial revolution, beginning of the second industrial revolution, to the third industrial revolution. You can see that transition happening within Western Union, because of Western Union. The difference that the communications made in the economy and the operations of these companies, these in the other industries, is what bridges the gap between the first and second industrial revolutions. And similarly, the communications issue becomes at something at the heart of the transition in the mid-20th century and into the third quarter of the 20th century for the second to third industrial revolution. And Western Union did not go quietly into the night. They really tried to make a play for being part of this and, you know, doing their own thing too. They weren't just copying what everyone else was doing. They were trying to do something different. It didn't work out for them, but it's an interesting arc up and down through American industrial history to look at. As always, all of the links that we've talked about will be up at arsenalfordemocracy.com when this episode goes up in a PDF, and you can check those out. There's various other articles that we didn't include, and I, of course, want to remind folks, if you missed our episode on the transatlantic telegraph cable and undersea communications cables from last year, we did unlock that. That is an episode that's linked in the notes. That's episode 367. And you should definitely check that out, because we talk about some of these other aspects around telegraphy and the physical material technology involved with these wires and cables, which was very complicated and expensive and has a lot to do with the structure of these companies and how they operated and the costs associated. But Rachel, before we close out today, I just wanted to get your sort of overarching thoughts on Western Union and this narrative that we've covered today, because it's really fascinating to me.
Yeah, there was a lot I didn't know about Western Union. I think because they're just so known as kind of this remittance provider, payment provider, it's easy to kind of forget the telegraphy, because it is kind of a forgotten technology. But it is interesting how they achieved their longevity, not through their communications innovations, but through their monetary service innovations, like offering the first credit card, offering these wire money transfers, offering international money transfers. Like, it's very interesting that that's how they stayed alive and how they've stayed relevant up to today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just really had a fun time talking about this and researching it because I didn't really know anything about this. And like you said, it's so easy to think of this as an old-timey telegraph line across the country next to a single track rail line, you know, and the tracks are also carrying the train filled with money to help replenish the cash reserves of such and such Western Union station in a particular remote location. And that's just one piece of the company's history. And it was such an influential company, even when it was losing, essentially, and going downhill and into decline, it was still really doing these interesting things that kind of show you the roads not taken in U.S. industrial history.
Yeah, it's interesting that telephones and telegraphs had kind of these parallel technological breakthroughs, but it just seemed like telegraphy just kind of lost time and time again to the telephone companies.
All right. Well, Rachel, thanks so much for coming on this week to talk about Western Union with me.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Things went wrong today. Bad news came my way. I woke up to find Western Union man, bad news in his hand, knocking at my